the Montana-Wyoming border, the light fading behind the Bighorn Mountains in a stringent purple that refused to turn black. I was surprised to see Lolo Long's brother still around. I figured he would have moved on by now. Henry looked out the window.
Did you know that most deer are born, live, and die within 1 square mile?
Barrett's not a deer.
No, but he is also not very adventurous.
Okay.
He wants to be a police officer, but he does not want to work for his sister, which limits his options.
I seem to remember that.
Perhaps you should offer him a job.
I glanced at him. Are you joking?
No.
He turned to look back at me.
Why would you think that?
He just said he didn't want to leave the res. Absaroka County is not that far. Besides, he could visit his family on weekends. He has a degree in law enforcement and speaks fluent Cheyenne and Crow. He could be an asset to you. I continued to drive into the darkness, aware that I was not the first white man to be bushwhacked in this territory. You've put some thought into this.
I would like to see him out from under his sister, and I think he is capable of more than simply pushing Lonnie around.
Vic took a break from petting dog and leaned forward between the seats. You really don't like her, do you?
Immaterial.
The bear pivoted to glance at her.
She is a dominating personality, and I think it is difficult for her brother, as a family member, to overcome that and find his own path.
What's his sister going to think about all this?
I do not see it as being any of her business.
Have you spoken to him? He turned back to me.
In a general sense, I mentioned that perhaps he should be looking elsewhere for a job. But I did not mention your department specifically.
He'd have to go down to Douglas for 2 months if we did hire him. I thought about it. We are an officer short, but I have to confer with my undersheriff on all matters concerning staff. You know my theory. If he's got a pulse and a pecker, we put him on patrol. The voice from the back confirmed. Besides, he can have my old unit after you buy me my new one.
Car shopping on a Sunday night?
There aren't any crowds or salespeople, for that matter. She sashayed up and down the rows of vehicles at the dealership in Sheridan. Do I have to go with silver or black and white? What if I want red? I called after,
"Join the fire department."
Henry leaned on the hood of a freshly minted pickup and watched her.
I think you have created a monster.
You may be right. I called out to her again. White, black, or silver, or combinations of all of the above.
Will the county actually pay for a new vehicle?
It'll have to go through the commissioners, but I don't see them saying no. Heck, I'm about to return a $2,000 computer.
I thought it was downstairs.
Yep, but nobody uses it.
Barrett would.
I laughed. You're really pushing this kid.
I think he is deserving.
That's it? He turned to look at me.
Meaning?
You're not just trying to get under Lolo Long's skin.
I never have to try very hard to do that.
I nodded as a security guard exited the main building of the dealership and walked toward us with a flashlight in hand. Which is why it surprises me that she's willing to ask us for help with this situation with her niece.
That tells you how desperate she is. I think she is correct in having you involved in an investigation, and she knows I can provide a measure of security.
The guard arrived, an elderly man with a more salt than pepper mustache and a black operational dress uniform, complete with ball cap and tactical shoes. He glanced at my truck, emblazoned with the Absaroka County Sheriff's stars, emergency lights, and dog's head hanging out the side window. Walt? I stared at the man, finally recognizing him as security from the Soldiers and Sailors Home.
Gene?
Yeah. Hey, how are you guys doing?
You work here, too?
Gotta make ends meet after retiring. He glanced at Henry and then back to me. I saw your truck and thought there might be a problem. I gestured toward Vic, who was now standing in front of a tricked-out half-ton with all the scoops, wheels, bells, and whistles.
My undersheriff needs a new unit.
Oh. He glanced at Henry again. I thought there might be something wrong.
Nope, just shopping.
Okay.
He started backing away and then waved as he turned and walked by Vic, who ignored him.
Henry watched him go.
Conscientious worker.
Maybe we can get Barrett a job here.
I pushed off and moved over to where Vic studied her potential truck.
So? I want this one.
Why?
It has a 10-speed transmission and close to 500 horsepower.
No.
She turned to look at me. What do you mean, no?
No, because you'd be dead in a week.
Placing her fists on her hips, she swiveled back and forth. You said I could have anything I wanted.
Within reason.
Why is this not within reason?
The bear joined us as I leaned forward, reading the window sticker. It costs as much as your house.
Half as much.
That's a lot of money for a truck.
I stepped back to look at it. Then we'd have to send it over to Jim at Michelina's to get all the emergency equipment put on the thing. I want it.
I glanced at Henry, who was smiling, and shrugged.
We'd have to put in a requisition with the county commissioners. I want it.
I sighed. On one condition.
What?
We put a roll bar on it. And a brick under the accelerator, the bear muttered. Res Dog wouldn't start.
What, she's tired?
The bear ignored me, and I glanced across the street at the T-Bird. Remind me again why you brought both vehicles into town. Lola needed an oil change. The bear continued staring at the engine bay of the old three-quarter ton as I held the flashlight, doing my best to illuminate the crosshatch of wiring that I myself had helped reconfigure at least four times.
How do you know which wire is which?
The yellow wire becomes brown at the firewall.
And what color does the brown wire become?
Yellow, I think.
That's convenient.
Vic appeared at the other side of the decrepit truck with three cans of Rainier that she'd retrieved from the refrigerator. She opened them and handed them to us in turn.
My neighbors called and wanted to know if this truck was abandoned and needed to be towed.
Henry pulled a wayward wire up into the flashlight beam with the remnants of twisted electrical tape. I wonder where this one goes.
I sipped my beer. How about I just give you a ride, and you can come back and get it in the morning?
He continued to study the Maverick wire.
Black.
What does the black become at the firewall?
Black.
You're kidding.
No, I had an extra spool of wire, so all the extra wires became black.
Extra?
Yes.
I glanced around the interior of the dark engine bay and the leaking Y-block.
I don't think they're supposed to be extra.
When you're as old as we are, there's always extra.
Pushing my hand down, he redirected the beam toward the distributor.
Is that a loose electrical wire on the base?
I peered under his arm to see what he was talking about. How the heck should I know? I haven't really looked under the hood of one of these things since 1972.
Deftly twisting the wires and rewrapping the electrical tape, the Cheyenne Nation stepped back from the grill like a surgeon abandoning the operating table and sipped his beer.
I'm going to attempt to start it, so if I were you, I would step away.
She can sometimes react unpredictably.
I joined Vic on the opposite side of the street.
Explosion?
Vic shook her head, sipping her beer. I'm thinking the engine will just drop onto the pavement.
Henry cracked the door, slid in on the bungee-corded shower curtain that served as a seat cover, and hit the starter. We listened as the solenoid engaged and cranked the remaining teeth of the flywheel, sometimes slipping and forcing the bear to hit it again. He grounded a few more times, and I was about to step forward when the engine caught and blew out a dark plume of blue-black smoke, hiccuped, caught, and belched into an uneven idle, or what passed for an idle, with Res Dog. Walking over as he reached across and wound down the passenger window, I took the half-empty can from him.
Heading out? He nodded.
I better.
Before she gets tired?
He said nothing and popped the clutch, allowing the refugee from a salvage yard to lay about 6 inches of rubber and then motored down Vic's street.
He took a left at the end of the block with only one taillight aglow.
I hope he makes it.
Me too.
Placing an arm over her shoulders, I walked her up the steps and across the sidewalk that bisected her small yard, stopping at the bottom as she mounted the first two steps and turned to look at me.
What is it about men and their vehicles?
I don't know. We get attached to things. She draped her arms around my neck, taking advantage of the fact that we were momentarily the same height. Just so you know. She glanced at the weather-beaten unit in her driveway that she'd been driving since I hired her. I'm not attached to that piece of shit. Wheeling my own vintage unit back onto Main Street, I drifted through the quiet town and rolled the windows all the way down for both Dog and me. He let his enormous head hang in the breeze, causing the heavy lips of his muzzle to flap. You had to take advantage of the decent weather on the high plains, or you missed it. I slid an elbow up onto the sill of my truck, took a deep breath, and slowly exhaled, luxuriating in the warmth of the night. I was about to pass the intersection that led up the mountain when I saw a strange car in our parking lot and somebody lying on the front steps. Thinking about how tired I was tempted to keep driving and continue on home, but that wasn't part of the job, so I turned and drove toward the entrance. Circling around, I paused behind the only vehicle in the lot, a silver import with California plates. Turning once more, I circled back in front of the old Carnegie Library we called the sheriff's office, stopped, and called out to the man who appeared to be asleep on our stairs, using a rucksack as a pillow. "Hello?" He didn't answer, so I switched off the ignition and climbed out, walking over and standing above him. He was dressed a little strangely for Wyoming, with patent leather shoes, checkered socks, a bright-colored shirt, an old leather jacket, and a pork-pie hat which covered his face. Kneeling down, I tapped his arm with the back of my hand. "Hey!" He moved this time, grunted, and readjusted on the marble steps. Tapping him again, I spoke a little louder. "Hey!" "What the fuck?" His hand came up and swiped the hat away, and I was surprised to see he was wearing sunglasses. He, on the other hand, was even more surprised to see me. "Oh, shit! Howdy!" Moving slowly, he rolled to one side and removed the shades. "Can I help you?" "You the sheriff?" "I am. I'm Bass Townsend." He stuck out a hand. "My grandfather was Charlie Lee Stillwater." Chapter 9. "You look like him."
"I do?"
He added sugar to his coffee, taking a pinch and throwing it over his shoulder. I thought that was only for salt. "I'm what you might call overly superstitious." Smiling into the mug as he stroked Dog's wide back, he took a sip. "My mother used to say, superstition is the poetry of life." "That was Charlie Lee's daughter, Ella."
"She was a nurse?"
"Yes, sir, that was her."
"And your father's name was Townsend?"
"Yes, they met when my mother was on a vacation in California. He was a commercial artist in Pasadena and did some work for Disney at one time. She always felt guilty about leaving my grandfather, but he said he was living the life of Riley up at the Soldiers and Sailors Home after my grandmother died, and that there wasn't anything she could do that they weren't already doing."
"Did you ever meet him?"
"Three times. Back when I was a kid, I actually spent a summer with him, and we went to Texas where he'd soldiered a bit the first time around. When my mama died, we kind of drifted away from each other, and I never saw him again." He sipped his coffee and looked up at me as we sat there on the bottom steps of the office that led to the jail proper.
"Did he suffer?"
I laughed. "Charlie Lee Stillwater never suffered a day in his life. The jury's not in until we get the autopsy and toxicology reports. But as far as I can tell, your grandfather died teasing a Texan during a bingo game."
"I thought he was born in Texas."
It always felt odd, telling people what they didn't know about the simple facts of their deceased relatives' lives. "He was born in St. Louis. But I guess he assumed the guise of a Texan after being there." "He's responsible for my name."
"Bass?"
"Yeah. Everybody in California thought I was named after a fish. But I believe I was really named after Bass Reeves, Deputy U.S. Marshal and model for the Lone Ranger. Not too bad for a black man during that time. 3,000 arrests and only had to kill about a dozen, as I recall. Not bad for any man in any period. Maybe that's why Charlie Lee wanted to be a Texan." He raised his head and glanced around the room and sighed. "I always figured my grandfather was born at the wrong time. I think what he really wanted to be was a buffalo soldier.
My father even did a painting of him, as he might have looked like one, but I don't know what happened to it.
I do. It's on his wall up at the veterans' home.
Really?
I'm pretty sure.
He sighed a quick laugh. I guess it meant more to him than he showed.
Not a good relationship between your father and your grandfather?
Not really. Well, I mean, my father was a quiet, soft-spoken man, and, well, you know how Charlie Lee was.
A little.
I sipped my own coffee.
How did you find out about his passing?
Got a call from the veterans' home.
I thought that odd, considering no one knew of any living relatives.
Carol Williams?
No, it was some kind of strange voice that said Charlie Lee had passed away and then just hung up.
Really weird shit.
Do you remember the name?
No, they left a message on my answering machine and didn't leave a name, just the regular number of the home.
He thought about it.
Had a strange voice, though.
Strange how?
Computer-generated, I suppose.
And you drove all the way here on that?
He laughed more openly this time. I've never seen this part of the world as an adult. The last time I was here, I was 7 years old.
If you don't mind my asking, Mr. Townsend, what do you do?
I'm a musician, blues guitar. But don't be too impressed. Every third person you meet in L.A. is a musician of some kind.
What are the other two?
Actors and lawyers. He finishes coffee. I do the club circuits and a little studio backup stuff. I played on a Blind Boy Paxton album, an Eddie Daniels, a John Bishop, and one with Bonnie Raitt.
Impressive company.
Yeah. And I've got the most impressive unair-conditioned four-story walk-up studio apartment in East L.A., with private parking in the alley by the dumpster out back.
He pet dog one last time and then stood, stretching and yawning, and returned his mug to the sink by the coffee maker.
As near as I can figure it, I've got just enough gas money to get me back to L.A. and maybe buy a few drive-through meals along the way.
He glanced around the dank day room and hallway leading to the jail cells.
I hate to be an inconvenience, but you wouldn't happen to have a spare bed around here, would you?
I do, but I can also call Jim down at the Blue Gables Motel and Coffee Bar and get you a room for the night.
They're music lovers, are reasonable, and I can spot you.
He turned to look at me.
Now, why in the world would you do that?
I think you should probably be getting this information from a more official source, but I think you're about to come into some serious money, Mr. Townsend. He looked a little uncertain and then laughed at the absurdity of my statement.
Oh, I know my grandfather never had a pot to piss in. I just thought that if there were any family items or photographs.
Well, there are a lot of things to go through in his room up at the home. And I mean a lot of things.
Hey, and if there's enough money to buy a few sit-down meals on the way back, that'd be great.
I nodded. I think there's enough to cover that.
Yep.
I still want a new truck. I wasn't going to use Charlie Lee's money for that anyway. She stuck her boots up on the edge of my desk and sipped her coffee.
Ruby gave me all the forms, and I called up the dealership this morning to run the numbers. They said they would come down on the price a little, but only a little.
Did you identify yourself as law enforcement?
About 6 times.
I looked at the post-its in my hand. A mild domestic dispute. A sideswiped car. Must be Monday. Well, the county commissioners will either come back with a yes or a no.
If they come back with a no, I'm going to the next meeting armed.
I'll write them a memo.
I glance around.
Where's my dog?
She tossed her head in the direction of the main part of the office.
With Ruby.
She yawned. So what's the millionaire like?
Superstitious.
I couldn't help but smile.
He doesn't know he's a millionaire yet.
You didn't tell him?
I didn't think it was my place. But I did tell him that he was probably going to need a lawyer.
What did he say to that?
That he couldn't afford one.
Oh, boy.
He's a musician. And I guess he's pretty good, maybe a little down on his luck.
Maybe he can do a benefit concert for himself. She dropped her boots to the floor. In the meantime, I'm ordering up the emergency equipment for my new truck.
Are you sure you don't want to wait till the commissioners have a vote?
Fuck that.
I'll put that in the memo, too.
You do that, she stood, stretched like a panther, and exited.
Ruby appeared in her stead.
We got a call on line one. Mary from Buffalo Bill Center of the West. My, aren't we all hoity-toity?
I'm attempting to rise from my hoi-polloi beginnings.
Picking up the phone, I punch line one. How's the patient? Embarrassed, but she's fine and already back at work this morning and then flying to Boston in the afternoon.
Catch the attacker?
I'm afraid not.
Nobody found a dropped wallet or anything in the conservation area?
Nope.
My painting rolled up in the dumpster out back?
She sighed an exhale of embarrassment, and there was a long pause. No, but I did want to call and apologize. We've never had anything like that happen here at the museum.
Probably my fault. There seems to be a lot of the criminal element in my proximity.
Was it insured?
I doubt it. The man who would have eventually owned it is here to settle his grandfather's estate, and with the amount of money we're talking about, I don't think he's going to be concerned about an odd little partial painting like that one.
It still bothers you, though, doesn't it? I can tell from your tone of voice.
I leaned back in my chair as far as I dared without flipping over, listening to it cry out in submission. That obvious, is it?
A little. It bothers me, too. Why in the world would anybody go to those lengths to steal that particular piece? I mean, if they were going to steal something, there are far more valuable pieces right there in the conservation area.
The thought did cross my mind.
Come up with any ideas?
Not yet.
Yet?
Yet.
Leaning forward, I sighed. Tell Beverly that I'm glad she's feeling better. I will. Walt.
There was another pause, and her voice took on a concerned tone.
You be careful out there with all that criminal element.
You bet. And you be careful with that artistic element. She laughed.
I'm not sure which one is more worrisome.
I hung up the phone and thought about it. Why in the world would somebody go to all the trouble of taking such an oddity? Even in the best of conditions, it was worth less than $1,000. I mean, I would understand if it was the actual painting, which, as the history books say, was destroyed in the fire in Texas. Fort Bliss, Texas. Fort Bliss. There are times when thoughts finally rub up against each other, enough that they provide a spark that should have ignited much sooner. Charlie Lee Stillwater had told me his first tour of duty with the Army had been in Texas, and he'd been discharged in 1946, the year of the commissary fire that had destroyed the painting. Had Charlie Lee taken that painting before it burned, or even caused the fire to cover his tracks? It just didn't seem like the man.
$3,400 for the lights, spotlight, and siren.
I looked up at my undersheriff, framed in the doorway.
What? My new unit, that you're going to buy me.
Oh, sorry. I glanced up at the Seth Thomas on the wall. I'm supposed to meet Bass Townsend over at the bank at 10. Do you want to go?
Sure. Maybe I can get a loan from him.
If you could imagine the response of a person who had just learned they'd inherited $1 million. Bass Townsend's wouldn't disappoint. I thought for a moment that the man had swallowed his tongue. But then he'd finally spoken, and it was what I myself might have said.
You're shitting me.
Well, maybe not exactly what I would have said. Wes Haskins seemed to be enjoying it, too. I mean, how many times do you get the opportunity to effectively give somebody a cool meal? It's $1 million in unmarked United States currency, and unless Walt here uncovers some reason why the money shouldn't be your grandfather's, you're quite a bit richer, Mr. Townsend. We all listened to the clock on the bank president's office wall.
You're shitting me.
Nope. And then there's the question of the security box he left that's in our protection. Wes smiled, in spite of himself and the greater banking industry. Of course, there will be probate and tax responsibilities. Your grandfather could have done a better job in delivering the money to you than cash in a boot box.
Townsend said nothing more, probably because he was afraid he might repeat himself again.
I sat forward in my chair as Vic leaned against the wall, preferring to stand and cover the smile on her face with a hand.
Are you all right, Mr. Townsend?
He still said nothing.
I said, are you all right?
I think...
I'm going to be sick. Wes was up in an instant, taking Townsend by the shoulder and helping him as we both led the man out of the office. The restroom is down there on the right. We watched as he moved carefully down the hallway and disappeared through the appropriate door as Vic joined us. Think he still thinks you're shitting him?
It's not unusual, that kind of response.
I've seen what a couple of $1,000 can do to people, but I've never actually told anyone about an amount as large as this in cash. He waited a moment and then glanced at me. Think he's okay?
I'll give him a minute and then check on him.
So, Wes, can I get a car loan if the county commissioners turn me down?
He glanced at Vic and then at me again.
She wants a new unit, and they've got one of those Pursuit half-tons over on a lot in Sheridan. One of those 500-horsepower jobs? He looked at her. You'll be dead in a week. She folded her arms. Shut up, Wes.
I told you, you drive too fast.
She glared at me. You shut up, too. Excusing myself, I headed down the hallway to the men's room, and, pausing at the door, tapped lightly. Mr. Townsend? There was a noise inside, but he didn't say anything. Mr. Townsend! The knob turned, and he opened the door a few inches and looked at me, his face covered with sweat.
Yeah? Are you okay?
Yeah, I just need another minute or two. I started to turn away, but he added, Is this really happening?
What's that?
Is this real? I mean, is there really $1 million that's really mine?
As near as we can tell, yes.
I'm honestly not feeling very well. He studied me for a moment more and then added, I just need a few more minutes.
I nodded. Well, whenever you're ready, but take as much time as you need.
He closed the door and I walked back down the hallway and rejoined the conversation.
I told her she could have it if it had a complete roll cage.
Shit, I forgot about the roll cage. She stared at me for a moment and then turned and started out of the bank, I assumed to cross the street to our offices to order a roll bar.
Wes watched her go and then turned back to me.
You realize you're creating a public menace?
I don't have final say. That's up to the county commissioners.
They're not going to tell you no, Walt.
They tell me no all the time. I glanced toward the restroom again. Ever had this big of a response?
He glanced at his wristwatch. No, not this much.
You think I should check on him again?
He adjusted his glasses and shrugged. Like I said, I've never had anyone have this long of a reaction.
We both walked down the hallway and I knocked again. Mr. Townsend?
No response.
Bass, are you all right in there?
Wes and I looked at each other, and then I tried the door, which was locked.
Mr. Townsend, if you don't answer, I'm going to have to break the door down.
I listened, but then looked at the banker. Do you have a passkey?
No.
I put my shoulder into it and felt the jam break apart. Townsend was lying on the floor, gasping for breath. I kneeled and felt the pulse at his throat and watched as his eyes fluttered. He looked up at me. I was sick, but then my chest started hurting, and I couldn't catch my breath.
Does your chest still hurt?
He nodded, and I turned to Wes, standing in the doorway. Get us an ambulance.
He's fine. It was a mild coronary blockage, aggravated by the agitation which might have caused an arrhythmia.
Standing with Isaac Bloomfield in the hallway of Durant Memorial Hospital, I was holding my hat and feeling a little guilty. I guess we didn't think that telling someone that they'd just inherited $1 million would give them a heart attack. The old concentration camp survivor smiled, pinching his lower lip with an extended thumb and forefinger. Medically, it was bound to happen. Unfortunately for you, perhaps, but fortunately for him, it happened on your watch. He's resting peacefully, and we have him on a mild sedation to allow him to regain his footing. Do you know of anyone we should notify?
Not that I'm aware.
When will I be able to speak with him?
He shrugged one shoulder.
Possibly an hour, possibly a day.
But he's in no danger.
Not at this point, I don't think. I mean, he had an episode, but I think he'll be fine.
David Nickerson came out of the room and approached us. He's asleep, and all his EKG readings are good. Does he have any genetic propensity?
Isaac nodded. His grandfather, the one we did the autopsy on, was a victim of cardiac arrest, but there were mitigating factors such as his age.
Anything more on that?
Not really,
As I said, it appears that he had some sort of injection the night of his death, but the toxicology report came back negative. There are some elements that might remain in urine or blood samples, but I suppose we'll never know because such samples don't exist.
What kind of elements?
Oh, speaking hypothetically, Sux, for example.
Sux?
Succomethonium chloride, part of the rapid sequence intubation protocol, which would include respiratory support, but has been used by some clever murderers in the past.
Nickerson snapped his fingers. The guy in New Jersey?
Isaac nodded. And Florida? They now have acquired the detection abilities in tissues and biological fluids to pick this stuff up, but you would need a urine or blood sample prior to death, which we don't have.
The younger doctor glanced back at the door where Bass Townsend was comfortably resting.
Perhaps we should do a little further testing just to be on the safe side?
Possibly.
They both looked at me. You're going to have to take that up with Mr. Townsend.
Slipping my hat back on, I turned to head toward the emergency entrance. You'll let me know if there are any changes in his condition?
They both called out the ubiquitous Wyoming response. You bet.
When I got to the curb, Vic was waiting for me in her soon-to-be-retired unit.
Get in.
I leaned against the door. If you're going to show me why you need a new unit, I'm not getting in this vehicle.
No, we got an emergency call from the Soldiers and Sailors Home.
I climbed into the nest she called a vehicle, pushing empty soda bottles, notepads, books, and fast food wrappers to the floor mat. What's going on?
Vic jetted out of the parking lot, took a right, and then made the next right onto 4th Street, winding through cars with her siren wailing and lights flashing a Morse code of get the hell out of my way.
What's up?
Somebody broke into Charlie Lee's room.
Good grief. Buckling my belt, I braced a hand against the dash in hopes of mitigating the impending crash.
Why are we in such a hurry?
Passing two cars on the left, she rocketed back into our lane, barely avoiding an oncoming semi whose horn rattled my fillings.
Police business.
When did this happen?
How should I know? Carol Williams called and said that the room had been broken into and that you might want to come up and take a look.
Once we'd barreled past the edge of town, I watched as she swerved around a slow-moving pickup and veered into the entryway of the veterans' home, the four men in their wheelchairs waving as if this were an everyday occurrence. Roaring past the first parking lot and the administrative offices, she turned the corner and slid sideways to a stop in the no-parking area in front. I glanced up at the bumper sticker-covered window on the second floor and could have sworn I could see someone's shadow quickly disappear. Vic threw open the glass doors and charged in as Country Joe McDonald strummed his guitar and warbled, "I feel like I'm fixing to die," from the speakers above.
"Are you coming?"
Breaking from my reverie, I turned and glanced at Vic and rushed after her as Carol intercepted us in the lobby.
It's okay, I've got the room blocked off.
When did it happen?
She walked along ahead of us. Must have been very early in the morning. The night man made his rounds at around 3 and didn't see anything. But the morning man spotted the door on his first pass.
We arrived at room 124, and it was obvious somebody had used a crowbar or something similar to pry open the heavy door. Looks like a professional job. Vic slipped on a pair of plastic gloves that she had taken from the kit in her unit and pulled the door open, which revealed an even greater mess than the one that had been there before.
Cripes!
Looking over her shoulder, I could see that all the piles of books and magazines had been toppled over and the artifacts had been swept from the shelves. Somebody was looking for something. I glanced around the room at the walls, but none of the hanging art was damaged. Nobody could have done this quietly.
Carol peeked in. The men on either side are medicated at night, and the rest in the area are pretty heavy sleepers.
Was Charlie Lee medicated?
She entered and made her way to one side, standing by the door to the bathroom, with a sack of books still sat on the toilet.
No.
Isaac says he might have had an injection the night he died.
She waved her hand before her nose.
He mentioned it, but there was nothing on the charts.
Did you have all the books cataloged?
I can't be sure, but it doesn't look as if anything had been taken.
She glanced in the bathroom.
God, that smell. I'm going to have to let housekeeping get in here.
I scanned the room. Why in the world would somebody come in here and dump the books over and... My eye caught something that appeared to be out of place.
Stepping over the collapsed stacks, I found an empty section of floor where the built-in elongated closet door hung partially open. Taking a pen from my pocket, I slipped it through the handle and pulled the door the rest of the way open. There were a few items hanging there, including
Charlie Lee's dress uniform, topped by a shelf for his hat and a remarkable ball cap collection, mostly military-themed. There were a few dress shirts that had been knocked to the floor of the cabinet, but what caught my eye was the back of the closet, where a faux wood panel had been pulled away. Curious, I reached in, took the items that were still hanging from the support rod, and handed them back to Vic. I gripped the panel, which popped away with ease, and then carefully turned it sideways in order to remove it from the closet. Reaching my hand back to Vic, I stuck my head inside. "Give me your mag light." She did as I requested, and then leaned in to watch as I shined the beam onto the open back, where the drywall was chipped away to reveal a space about 14 inches between the studs in the wall. Turning the beam upward, I could see that there was a hidden compartment that broke through the ceiling where the sill wood had been carefully chiseled away in a circle that continued upward. "What do you think is up there?" I turned to look at my undersheriff.
"Nothing."
"Nothing?"
"Nothing now, but I'd be willing to guess that if you rolled up a 9.5-foot by 14.5-foot canvas, it would fit in this little cubby perfectly."
She looked back at Carol, who stood near the bathroom door. "Are you telling me there was a $24 million painting propped up in this closet the whole time?"
"Possibly."
I watched as she stepped into the bathroom and reached for the toilet handle.
"Don't flush that."
"So who took it?"
"I wish I knew."
As she drove away from the veteran's home, I thought about it.
As near as I can figure, Charlie Lee had only one thing in his life that could have been worth $1 million.
"A $24 million painting?"
"Yep."
"So you think he sold it?"
"Possibly." I thought about it. Selling a $24 million painting for $1 million? Of course, it's difficult to sell one that was presumed destroyed and in possession of the 7th Cavalry Headquarters, a branch of the United States military, and, in proxy, the United States federal government.
They have a lot of lawyers.
Yep, they do.
Watching the rolling scenery go by, I was momentarily mesmerized by the glimmering sun reflecting through the quaking leaves of the trees like vibrating $1 million bills. I looked past the brick sign and the chiseled marble that made up the entryway to Fort McKinney and at the four wheelchairs parked by the road.
"Stop!"
She glanced at me.
"What?" "Stop!"
She locked the brakes and the aged SUV slid to a halt as I flung open the door, circled around the hood, crossed the sidewalk, and stood in front of the waivers. The old serviceman looked up at me in mild surprise as I stood there and studied each of them in turn. Army Command Sergeant Major Clifton Kaufman was going light today with an outlandish Hawaiian shirt, but the ubiquitous boonie hat still covered his crown. Kenny Cade, Chief Petty Officer, was wearing a blue T-shirt with a blue-nosed polar bear emblem I recognized from my time in Alaska. Air Force Master Sergeant Ray Perdue was still peering at me from under his cap with the scrambled eggs on the bill, and Delmar Pettigrew, the oversized Sergeant Major of the Marines, was still holding down the far right with the everyday attire of satin jacket and red cap. I continued to study them and gave them a moment to study me as I slowly took off my sunglasses, summoning as much of my former commissioned officers as I could muster. Kenny was the first to clear his throat.
"Can we help you, Lieutenant?"
I waited another moment and then delivered the word slowly.
"Custer's last fight."
They stared at me, their eyes collectively widening a bit. Clifton had a coughing fit, and now they were looking at one another before allowing their eyes to come back to me.
We stood or sat like that for a few more moments before Navy summarily pivoted in his electric wheelchair and drove off down the miniature rolling highway that led back toward the home. Army followed suit, along with Air Force, which left me staring at my comrade in service, Marine Corps, when he suddenly turned and followed after the others. Watching the diminutive convoy disappear over the hillocks, I became aware of Vic standing beside me.
"So, you want me to shoot out their tires?"
Chapter 10. I can't see, but in a way I can see more clearly than ever before. There are small swirls and swipes, muted patterns, brushstrokes of mostly browns and greens,
with figures darting from all sides under a flat sky with waves of heat on a July high plains day. There's dust, and there are noises, screaming high and loud, not all of it human. I've got my hand around another man's arm where a cuff of some kind embraces his bicep, and some sort of bone breastplate strains across his chest. Dark with dark features, he's wearing some sort of headdress, but it's a strange one, and the orange feathers on top make it look like his head is blooming. The heat, the dust, and the noise are so oppressive that I feel like dropping back and resting in the high grass that overlooks the river in the valley below. But he's moving, and I watch his other hand as it rises up, blocking out the sun for just a moment, and I'm almost glad for the shade. He hesitates, and our eyes meet, joined in disbelief. There's a stone club in his hand, the clear tawny sinew, the red paint on the river rock, and the delicate feathers that flitter a rainbow of color in the sun. Then, with all his might, he brings it down into my face.
"Earth to Walt. Come in, Walt."
Hearing her voice in the distance, I turned in what seemed like slow motion as the images faded and disappeared.
"What?"
She leaned back on the bench that rests on the bridge spanning Clear Creek. She sipped her soda, her unfinished grilled cheese sandwich lying on the wrapper in her lap.
"I'm so glad you're not having those spells anymore."
Taking a deep breath, I stretched my neck muscles and listened to the popping noises.
"How long?" "About 2 minutes. I'm sitting here chattering away, and I look over, and you're staring off into the ozone. Did Doc Bloomfield say if this was supposed to go away?"
"He didn't."
"Well, at least they're getting shorter."
She continued to study me.
"So, what was this one?"
"I think I was at the Little Bighorn, or in a painting of the Little Bighorn." She nodded.
"Were you an Indian?"
"I don't think so." "Well, then this one ends badly." She sighed and stared at me. "So I'll repeat my most recent question. Did Charlie Lee sell the painting, and did the purchaser come back to retrieve it? And if so, why trash the place?"
"Huh?"
"For the third time, did Charlie Lee sell the painting, and did the purchaser come back to retrieve it? And if so, why trash the place?"
I tried to concentrate. It is so hard these days.
"A warning?"
"To who? Charlie Lee is dead."
I leaned forward, rested my elbows on my knees, and listened to the rushing sound of the water beneath us as the twilight shouldered the sun to the west. We sometimes got our dinner to go from the Busy Bee Cafe, only 20 yards away, and then ate it on the bench to avoid the summer crowds. Maybe they were frustrated when they couldn't find it.
Or maybe they were frustrated, and then they did.
Dog sat beside her, or more important, beside the remains of her sandwich, adjusting his weight as she regarded him.
"I'm going to give you some, but you have to wait."
Who in the world has $1 million in cash to throw around?
"The federal government.
It's their penny, so they don't have to buy it." She picked up her sandwich, but then paused mid-bite to look at me.
"Are you going to call in DCI to dust the place?"
"I'm trying to decide if they have better things to do."
$1 million worth of better things?"
"I know, I know."
"How long are you going to sweat the Joint Chiefs of wheelchairs up at the home?"
"I haven't decided yet. Probably till tomorrow."
"They're going to be trying to get their story straight."
"Yep."
"Hey, how come there aren't any Coast Guard guys up there?"
"Most are under 6 feet tall and drown when their ship sinks and they try and walk to shore." She stared at me.
"Sorry. Old Marine joke."
"So the next time there's something really important, I'd rather not have you or Wes tell it to me. Capiche?"
I thought we were relatively gentle in the delivery of the information.
"He had a heart attack, Walt."
"Bloomfield and Nickerson said he was heading in that direction anyway, and that we just exacerbated the condition a bit."
"No way he was up at the home looking around."
I turned to glance at her.
"Hey, everybody's a suspect until we catch someone."
I leaned back on the bench and smiled at some tourists on their way to the bandstand for Dave Stewart's Bluegrass Night. No, he was waiting on the steps of the office when I got there and then stepped over at the Blue Gables.
You sure?
I called Jim at the office. He said Bass checked in, went to his cabin, and didn't appear till morning when he came out and ordered a cappuccino. Lucky for him, he's staying in the only place in the state of Wyoming that has such a device. She handed the rest of her sandwich to Dog, and we watched as he swallowed it in one great snapping gulp.
Jesus!
She checked her fingers to make sure she hadn't lost any.
It's like the shark tank at SeaWorld.
He doesn't have very good manners.
She stood and took a few steps toward my truck.
So, what's the game plan?
I guess I have to call DCI. We haven't got much to work with since I let the most important piece of evidence be stolen.
Well, we know it was the real deal, that's something.
I stood up and we walked along Main Street until we got to the truck, where I opened the rear door so that the beast could jump in. He sat on the sidewalk looking at me, just to make sure I wasn't fooling him by uttering the word ham.
Get in, it's not a trick.
I glanced at Vic. He's got a memory like an elephant. She reached out and battered his nose.
Get in, you moron!
With the possible exception of Henry and Ruby, I figured Vic was the only one who could get away with that and then watch as he jumped in. I closed the door and had started around the truck when I noticed she wasn't getting in. I stopped at the front fender and rested an elbow on the hood between us. What, I have to beg you to get in too?
Are you happy?
I laughed until I saw the seriousness in the tarnished gold eyes.
What? Are you happy?
What are you talking about? She rested both forearms on the hood and placed her chin there, studying me.
Are you happy? It's a simple question.
What is this all about? She set her eyes on me for a good long while and looked very serious. It was more than a little unsettling.
These fits that you're having, where you just go away, are you sure it's not something simple, like maybe you actually want to be somewhere else?
I thought about it. I don't think so. I mean, it's usually not a pleasant experience. She looked down the street.
You'd tell me, right?
Tell you what?
If something was wrong?
I studied her until she finally turned to look at me.
Yes, I would.
Cool.
She pushed off the truck and started down the block at a saunter.
Hey, you don't want to ride?
Nah, I'll walk.
She paused and considered the goods behind the plate glass of one of the stores as I studied her reflection.
You do the same for me, right?
She stood without moving and then finally turned just enough for me to see the side of her face.
Have you ever known me to hold my feelings in check?
The sly smile held for a few seconds, and then she walked off, the Glock bouncing on her hip as she checked the door of every shop on Main Street to make sure they were locked. Watching her until she turned the corner at the end of the block, I finally opened the door and climbed in, turning to look at my companion. Next time, just get in the truck, okay? Doubling back, I took the left and then another left, parking in our lot and letting Dog out. I unlocked the door to the office and allowed the beast to go up the stairs to Ruby's chair first. I didn't bother to turn on the light, but picked up her phone, called DCI in Cheyenne, got an answering machine, and, after telling a shortened version of the situation, requested its assistance in fingerprinting a room at the Soldier and Sailor's home. It was about then that someone picked up the phone, and I recognized the voice of Steve Woody Woodson, the director.
You're kidding.
I wish I were.
Stuffing the phone into the crook of my neck, I glanced around.
Why, do you get the big dog if you call DCI during off hours? Nobody else is here, and I was walking by the reception desk when I heard a familiar voice. Did you say $1 million?
I did.
And something about a Custer painting?
I did.
I'm getting in my car and heading up there right now.
Woody, wait. I mean, you can wait till tomorrow.
This is the most interesting case I've heard of in years, and I'm not letting anyone else have it. Whatever you do, don't call the field office in Sheridan or Gillette.
I'm not calling anybody else, Woody.
How's the fishing up there this season?
I knew there was an ulterior motive in all this.
No, but if I'm driving all that way, I might bring a rod and wet a fly or two. I'll call the Ferg and get you the lowdown. He's still working for you?
Retired. I think law enforcement was getting in the way of his fishing.
I understand perfectly.
I hung up the phone and glanced around at the graceful cursive writing on the assorted notes, forms, and papers that made up my dispatcher's desk. I'd heard that they were going to stop teaching cursive in schools, which is fine with me because then all of us old people would have a secret code. I was about to get up when I noticed that Dog had walked to the end of the counter and was looking toward the main entrance. He stood there a moment more and then approached the edge. There was a gasp from the entryway and then a voice, "Oh, my God!" I stood and walked to the end of the counter and grazed my fingers on his back to let him know I was there and then peered over the edge to where what appeared to be a woman in a hoodie stood plastered against the glass door.
"Howdy?"
Putting the hood down to reveal her blonde hair, Katrina Dijon looked up at me and sighed. I thought I was a goner there for a moment.
"Only if you were a ham. Can I help you?"
She smiled. "Katrina Dijon from the Buffalo Bill Gala?" Taking a few more steps, I sat on the edge, and Dog went down to greet her properly, with his tail in full wag.
"I know. Is there something wrong?"
She petted Dog and came up the steps, stopping a few down to look me in the eye.
"What? A girl can't just stop by to see the sheriff?"
"Sure, but it's after hours."
"I saw your truck and thought I'd try your door."
"Well, we're here. Is there something I can help you with?"
"This is going to sound odd."
"Okay."
"There was a notice on one of the social media marketplace sites about a lost set of rings that were found."
I thought about the report Sizer Bertori had given me a few days ago, and I was sure that, as tech-savvy as he was the one who had posted it.
"An engagement set."
"I think they're mine."
"Really?"
"I came through Durant a few days ago on my way to Cody and stopped in a parking lot on the way up the mountain, and I think I lost them there."
"Can you describe them?"
"Better, I can show you a picture."
She held out her phone, turning the screen to show the self-same rings on her own hand, or at least a hand similar to her own with the same fingernail polish.
"Sure looks like the ones that were found."
"Oh, thank goodness. From what I am to understand, they were quite remarkable. Almost $30,000 worth."
"That's remarkable, that's for sure. Mind telling me how it happened?"
"I threw them away. I was angry."
$30,000 worth?"
She crossed to the side, resting her back against the railing and spreading her hands on the steel.
"I don't suppose you've ever done anything stupid like that?"
"Daily, actually."
"I was mad at the individual who gave them to me."
"A natural response to a very expensive gift." She sighed, smiling, and looking down at her tennis shoes.
"I've been trying to get this person to ask me to marry him for years, and he finally did, but the timing was wrong."
She looked up at me.
"I'm interested in somebody else, and he thought the rings would bring me back."
"It didn't work?"
"No, but I felt bad about throwing them while on the phone with him, and even worse when I couldn't find them."
"Sounds like a stormy relationship."
"To say the least."
She continued studying her shoes. I studied her.
"It sounds like you want to tell me about it."
Her eyes came up.
"I guess I just want to talk to someone, and sometimes a relative stranger is best because they're not involved."
Dog realized from our tone of voice that the conversation was going to be a lengthier one, so he sidled up the steps and collapsed beside me with one great heaving breath and closed his eyes. She looked alarmed, and I assured her, "If we aren't talking about meat products, he gets bored." She didn't look any less puzzled, but I continued. "It sounds like more than a personal problem. Tell me, has the Count gotten himself into some kind of trouble I should know about?" She stared at me.
"Possibly."
"I'm all ears."
I reached up and stroked the missing portion, except for the small part of one I lost a few years ago.
"You're a funny man to be a sheriff."
"You're not the first person to say that."
"No, about the Count.
There are people, and mind you, Philippe knows many of them, who will pay for the things they want badly, no matter what the price."
"I've heard of such people."
"They are in the habit of getting the things they want."
Yep.
Philip is in the business of getting those types of things for those types of people.
I see.
Sometimes things that aren't supposed to exist.
Things like Custer's last fight.
She was silent for a moment, then spoke to her feet. I'm feeling bad about being involved in all this.
Involved in what, exactly?
She practically whispered, I feel as if I've already said too much.
Actually, as a man who is the investigator in a case involving a missing legendary painting, $1 million in cash and a man's death, I don't think you've said nearly enough.
A man's death?
Charlie Lee Stillwater. I thought his death was accidental. I smiled and shook my head. So you know the man?
It took her a while to respond. I never said that.
Katrina, your accent is very good, but I can still detect just a touch of far western Russia in there somewhere. Possibly St. Petersburg? You see, I had a friend while I was working in Alaska years ago who was from that same region, and you sound remarkably like him.
Her voice, along with the Russian umlaut, took on a defensive tone. And what does that have to do with anything?
I threw a thumb over my shoulder. I've got 4 guys who sit out in front of the Soldiers and Sailors Home who say they've had dealings with people they refer to as the Russians, and as near as I can tell, you, Serge, and Philippe are the only ones who fit that bill.
I've said too much.
Possibly. But this conversation took a professional turn for me, and now I'm going to need you to answer some more questions.
She looked toward the door but didn't move, only folding her arms. I don't really know more than what I've told you. You need to talk to Philippe.
I stood, aware that I was towering over her. I guess I do.
Am I under arrest?
No, but I think I'll have you accompany me over to the Count's house for a little chat and to get things straightened out.
Now?
No time like the present.
I really don't want to go over there for personal reasons.
I really don't care. You come in here and open this can of worms, and now you want to just turn around and walk away? I'm afraid I can't allow that. Right now, the only thing I've got you on would be conspiracy and collusion to the tune of grand larceny. But that's certainly enough to detain you if you continue to not cooperate.
You know what I said about you being a funny man to be a sheriff? I take that back.
Okay. But in the meantime, let's just be 2 folks taking a 20-minute ride to a guy's house and having a conversation about what the heck is going on around here.
Okay.
One more thing?
She turned to look at me. Yes?
Do you still want your rings? Story is on the frontier of 2 counties, Sheridan and mine. A picturesque western community, it boasts of a couple of supper clubs and inns, along with a gas station and a guest house known as the Waldorf Astoria. Having long been a haven for the independently minded along the foothills of the Bighorn Mountains, it is popular with the artistic set. Taking the exit near the fishery, I glanced over to see her admiring the engagement ring that she'd been reacquainted with as she turned to look at me.
That woman who was with you the other night, I understand she's your second in command?
She is my under-sheriff.
And is she more than that?
I gave her a sidelong glance. I'm sorry, but that's really none of your business. She laughed.
Oh, come on now, Sheriff. I've been dumping all my personal problems out for you. Don't you think turnabout is fair play?
What leads you to believe my personal situation is any problem?
Oh, they all are, aren't they?
Not really.
I must be doing something wrong.
I turned left into Story proper, past the manicured lawns and small log cabins, passing the town sign and firehouse.
Where to?
Keep going straight, then right on Lauk's and left on Route 2 toward Penrose Trailhead. I did as she said, and we followed North Piney Creek west to where the road turned to gravel. I never even knew there were houses out here.
Only one. Do you know the story?
I heard it's a castle.
She shook her head. Actually, the barn of a small abbey in Ireland that the Count had disassembled, brought over and reconstructed.
At a reasonable price, I'm sure.
She sighed, scrunching into the seat. Like I said, Philippe knows people who, if they want something, they get it. And a little of that might have rubbed off.